These years we deserve some creature comfort, he said. No more stones underneath our sleeping bags. He looked up at her. What's up? She didn't have the heart to cancel. So she called Mina and told her she had to do something with her dad. And it all worked out, because Ryan asked her to go to the movies alone a week later, and he didn't just put his arm around her. He kissed her during the credits, and Ren had felt the way she imagined a star did when it exploded. On the night of the Perseid meteor shower, Ren and her father had hiked to their usual spot and pitched the tent and spread the bedrolls and arranged the sleeping bags. Her dad cooked hot dogs on sticks over a campfire, and they roasted marshmallows. They set up the telescope, and Ren scanned the night sky.
Do you remember when I showed you Betelgeuse? Her father said, and you asked which came first, the star or the movie?
I was like 7, Ren protested. He laughed. She stepped away from the scope and stretched out beside him. It's dying, isn't it?
Betelgeuse? Yeah, it's a red giant. So it's cooling.
That's kind of sad. Her father grinned.
You won't be around to see it die if that makes you feel any better.
I guess if you have to go, a supernova's a flashy way to do it. One day Betelgeuse would explode in a tremendous spark of light, leaving behind a planetary nebula. And as all that dust and gas cleared, all that would remain of it would be a tiny white dwarf star. A core without fire.
Nothing lasts forever, her father said.
She and her father had seen plenty of white stars through the telescope. She wondered which ones from her childhood were gone now, and whether they were actually dead, or if they were just too faint to emit light. Did you have to be missed to exist? When the first streak of light had grazed the sky, she'd sat up, breathless. What followed was a visual symphony, strafing the dark as if someone had shaken the constellations like dice and rolled them across the night. Sometimes I forget how beautiful it is, she whispered.
Me too, her father said,
his voice tight. When she turned, he wasn't looking at the meteors. He was looking at her. If she died, she would be missed. Ren felt her eyes well up. What had she been doing this morning that was so important that she hadn't spent an extra 5 minutes at the table with her father, telling him she loved him, or for that matter, about Ryan? Or that lately she woke up with the blankets tangled around her feet and her heart racing because she was afraid of not finding her tribe in high school, and that she'd bomb her PSATs and never go to college, and suddenly everything was happening too fast. Last year, for her birthday, her father had gotten her tickets to a Neil deGrasse Tyson lecture. They had traveled to Atlanta to hear him speak. The astrophysicist had talked about dark energy. It was a real, measurable pressure in the universe that scientists didn't truly understand yet, which was forcing the universe to expand beyond our horizon. One day, he said, astronomers would only be able to track the stars of the Milky Way and not other galaxies. They would have moved out of sight, like the last chapter of a book that had been torn away. Maybe we were already only seeing part of the story, already missing chapters. You don't know what you don't know, Neil deGrasse Tyson had said a year ago. But now, for the first time, Ren really understood. It had been Pastor Mike's wife, Earlene, who first mentioned the problem to George. Lil's hair. It was unmanageable. He, too, had noticed that her baby fine curls had somehow become matted in places. He had tried to brush it,
but the bristles caught on the snarls and Lil would start to cry. Then Earlene stopped him when he was cleaning out the gutters of the church on a summer day that was easily 100 degrees. She stood below the ladder with a glass of lemonade for him. He thanked her, and as he drank, she looked off in the distance to where Lil and some of the other kids from the church were playing on a swing set.
"You know, one of mine had hair like that, just as uncontrollable as she was."
Earlene laughed.
"I used to wash her hair in the tub at night with shampoo and conditioner and braid it wet so it couldn't get tangled while she slept."
She took the empty glass from him and smiled.
"Don't you go getting sunstroke on me, hear?"
Earlene had the sweetest way about her, finding ways to make suggestions without being critical. George had never met a woman like that. Certainly his mama wasn't that way, and if his wife had been more like Earlene, maybe he wouldn't have gotten so angry all the time. That night when he gave Lil her bath, he told her she was going to Daddy's hair salon. He tugged a comb through her damp hair, working conditioner into the places where the tangles were tough, and razoring away one spot that had turned into the beginning of a dreadlock. Then he divided her hair into 3 sections, clumsily crossing his fists over each other to make a lopsided braid. He secured it with a rubber band and tucked her in. The next morning, when he unwound the braid, Lil's hair spilled over her shoulders like a shining waterfall.
"Daddy," she said that night, "braid it again."
George bought hair ribbons at the drugstore and elastics that didn't catch on Lil's fine hair. It became a twice daily ritual. He would sit her on a kitchen stool and stand behind her, brushing her hair rhythmically and braiding it for bed. In the morning, he'd comb through the waves. As he got braver, he made a part and fashioned pigtails. He learned how to pull her hair back into a barrette. He went to the library and watched videos on the internet about how to do a French braid, a bun, a fishtail. There was no question that he took pride on Sundays, when at church mothers came up to him and complimented him on Lil, or when people were surprised to find out that she was being raised by a single father. He was a man who'd been told he'd done wrong all his life, and this was balm on a wound. But what George loved the most was the magic that happened between him and Lil when it was just the two of them, running the brush through her curls. George knew he was a quiet man, not given to, well, chit-chat. But when he was standing behind his daughter, with his hands in her hair, she talked to him, and he started to talk back. They talked about silly things, whether they'd rather have a fire pole in the house to get from upstairs to downstairs, or a swimming pool full of jello, what they'd buy if they won the Powerball, if Batman would kick Wonder Woman's butt or vice versa. There was something about standing behind Lil and not making eye contact that made talking easier for them both, even when the conversation turned tougher. Standing up to the girls at church who bullied her for wearing the same dress every Sunday. Understanding that a boy who stuffed a frog down her shirt might have actually been trying to get her to notice him. Talk of her mama. George lived for those moments, twice a day, when he did his daughter's hair. Then, one night, when Lil was 14, she didn't come into the kitchen after her shower. George found her in her room, her elbows twisted behind her head, weaving her hair into a braid.
"It seems silly for you to do it," she said, "when I can do it myself."
George didn't know how to say it wasn't about that, but about the moments he spent with her. He didn't know how to explain that each sweep of a brush could jog something in a teenager that she didn't even know she was holding inside. He didn't know how to say that seeing her fix her own hair filled him with a terrible heaviness,
as if this was the beginning of the end. So he said nothing at all. If Lil had still let him braid her hair, would he be here now? Or would she have realized that there was nothing she could do or say that would make her seem less perfect to him? Would she have known that whatever knot she had gotten into, they would untangle together? He had put down the telephone receiver because it hurt his ear. It was on speakerphone now, and he was pacing in front of the desk where you signed in. But Hugh McElroy had stopped talking, and so had George, both lost in their thoughts.
"You still there?" George asked. "Of course," Hugh replied.
And then, from somewhere behind the desk, he heard a sneeze. Immediately, Izzy sneezed too. She faked a series of sneezes, an allergic jag that should have won her an Oscar. If she could convince the shooter that it had been her, instead of the two people hiding in the supply closet behind the desk, then maybe they would stay safe. If the shooter found them, he'd also realize that Izzy had lied to his face when she told him it was empty. He spun around, stalked to the closet, and yanked open the door. "George," Hugh said. He could hear commotion and shouting and something clattering.
"George, talk to me." His heart began to pound. "What the fuck is going on?"
Hugh heard a grunt, a scuffle.
"Get up! Get up!" George yelled. "George, what's going on?"
Hugh tried again. He swallowed his worst suspicions.
"Are you all right? Did something happen?"
There was a crash and a cry, and then Ren's voice.
"No, no, no, don't!"
All of the air left Hugh's lungs. He was paralyzed, terrified for her. His only hope lay in calming George down before he did the unthinkable.
"George," he urged, "I can help. I can—"
"Shut up,"
George said, and there was a clatter, and then the line went dead. 1 p.m. The shooter had hung up, but Hugh was still triumphant. He had the first puzzle piece he needed for this negotiation. George Goddard had revealed, maybe intentionally and maybe not, what had brought him to the center today. The greatest weapon a negotiator had was information. Knowledge was power. Wasn't that what he always told Ren? When Ren was in middle school, and he still packed her lunches, he used to include a sandwich, a bottle of water, an apple, and a nugget of knowledge. On a piece of paper, he'd write a fact. There's a planet where it rains glass. If you cry in space, the tears stick to your face. There's a tiny aluminum sculpture on the moon. Your body is made out of bits of stars that exploded. Atoms are mostly extra space. And if you squeezed all that space out of the atoms that make up humans, the rest of the mass could fit in less than 1 square inch. The Milky Way has 4 arms, not 2. None of these facts had included how to hide in a hostage situation, how to protect yourself if someone comes at you with a gun and you're unarmed. Hugh could have easily filled her head with that wisdom because it was the bulk of his career knowledge. But for reasons he could not fathom right now, he had instead fed her information that would make her the hit of a cocktail party. Knowledge was power, and he had left his daughter without a weapon, which meant this was up to him to fix.
"You," he called to a young detective, "find out what George Goddard does for a living. If he's married, how long he's lived in Mississippi, if there's a bar he hangs out at, where he bought his gun, if he has any priors."
The woman blinked at him.
"Now!"
She scurried off, and Hugh sank down on the folding chair behind him. He buried his face in his hands. He might already be too late to help his sister. He could not afford to make a mistake. It wasn't just his professional reputation on the line this time. The Milky Way has four arms, not two. It wasn't that the silhouette of the galaxy had changed. It was that often you couldn't see the shape of something when you were stuck inside it. You couldn't be objective if you were too close. It was why doctors did not operate on relatives, and judges recused themselves from matters that involved them, and hostage negotiators stepped back from situations where they had a vested, personal interest. Well, Hugh thought, fuck that. Bex lay on her back, feeling the soup of her breathing, drowning even on dry land. Everything hurt. Inhaling, exhaling, blinking. She was dizzy and faint and felt as if a pike had been driven through her chest. At least Ren was safe, still. If Bex had to die to keep it that way, she would do it. She should have told Hugh. She could have told him what Ren had asked her to do and made him swear not to tell Ren that she had said anything. Then he would have known they were going to the clinic, at least. He would know she was in there. But Bex knew from personal experience that the minute a father realized his baby girl wasn't a baby anymore, something infinitesimal changed in the relationship. Even if it seemed outwardly solid and unaltered, you could still sense it, like the broken bone that never properly healed, or the hairline crack in the vase to which your eye was unerringly drawn. And so she had kept Ren's secret. She was good at that. She felt herself starting to shiver. Did that mean she was in shock? That she had lost too much blood? Everyone in this room, she realized, had a story that ended within these walls. If today hadn't happened, many of those stories would have gone untold. There were 100 different paths that led to the corner of Juniper and Montfort, from pregnancies that were unwanted to those that were cherished, but impossible to carry through. From young girls who were trying to do the right thing to the relatives who lied for them. Here was the one thing all these women had in common. They hadn't asked for this moment in their lives. It was getting harder to breathe. Bex tried to turn her head toward the closet, just in case Ren could miraculously see her through the slats. It hurt so much that the edges of her vision went a hot, searing white. Bex made a promise to herself. If she got out of here, if she survived, she would tell Hugh the truth. All of it. George stared down at the gun in his hand. Now what? He had imagined his vengeance as if it were a movie he had seen long ago, where someone wronged took justice into his own hands. He saw himself bursting through the front door of the center with his gun raised like Stallone or Willis. He saw a doctor cowering under the heel of his boot. He saw an apocalyptic landscape of destruction left in his wake as he emerged, the vanquisher. Here is what had not been part of his vision. The ringing in his ears when the gun fired. The spray of people's blood. The way they begged for mercy. George glanced at the group of people huddled in the waiting room. The doctor, injured. The nurse who was hovering near him. The blonde girl who kept tugging at her hair. The one who had just killed her baby. The lady who was struggling to breathe. He had done that to her. It made George feel sick, watching her suffer. In the abstract, eliminating everyone who was tied to the center had seemed masterful, necessary. In truth, it was messy. These people were puppets, and their strings were made of terror. Their whispers died the minute he looked at them. "I'm not who you think I am," George wanted to say. But that was no longer true. He was exactly who these people thought he was. His frustration and fury had been a live grenade dropped into his hands. What was he supposed to do with it? Let it tear him to pieces? Instead, he had run, far and fast behind enemy lines, and then he had thrown it right back at them. They huddled together in the waiting room, leaving as large a gap between themselves and George as they could. They seemed to be waiting for something from him, a demand, a tantrum, an explanation. They had all heard him talking to the cop. They knew there was someone out there who wanted to rescue them. Hope was a pretty damn good weapon. On the other hand, George had this pistol. When he waved it, they jumped, they cried, they shivered. They listened to him. He just had no idea what to say. He started to pace. He had come here with intention, but not with a plan. Somehow he hadn't imagined that there would be people left when he finished teaching his lesson of retribution. He knew how these things ended, in a standoff, with him and a bunch of cops in flak jackets. But then, he had more leverage than just the gun. He had hostages. Wren hugged her knees to her chest in the closet and cursed herself for being conscientious. Who knew that trying to be responsible was deadly? She could have been like most teenagers on the planet and just waited until things got so intense between her and Ryan that it was too late to plan ahead. She could have brought a pack of condoms to the register at the Rite Aid, or she could have told Ryan that it was his problem. But there had been a girl in her homeroom last year who'd gotten pregnant and had stayed in school until her water broke during gym class. Wren had sat on the bleachers with her till the ambulance arrived, holding her hand while the girl's fingernails squeezed little half-moons of pain into her skin. "Is there anything I can do?" Wren had asked, and the girl had turned to her, panting, and said, "Yeah, use anything but Trojans." So instead, she and Ryan had talked about it. When to do it. Where to do it. Since Ryan was the one who was working out those logistics, Wren volunteered to be the one in charge of birth control. Which, as it turned out, was easier said than done when you were a minor and trying to keep your private business private. So much for not being a risk taker. You could take all the precautions in the world, and bad things still happened. That made her think of her aunt. When Wren's dad went to hostage negotiator training for a few days and Bex babysat, she'd let Wren skip school. She called it a mental health day. They would lie wedged together in her hammock in the backyard, like peas in a pod, and play a game of choice. Would you rather grow a tail or grow a horn? Would you rather always be too hot or always be too cold? Would you rather stay overnight in a haunted mental hospital or have to ride a broken roller coaster? Would you rather eat nothing but stuffing or drink only gravy? Would you rather know the day you're going to die or know how you're going to die? For Wren, the answers were obvious. A tail, because you could hide it in clothing. Be too cold, because you could add layers to get warm. Stay at the mental hospital, because being terrified beats getting killed. Stuffing, because it was stuffing. And knowing the method of your death would be better, she had been sure, than counting down how much time you had left. Wren was currently rethinking that last answer. Now Wren thought of another one. Would you die if it meant someone else could live? Was that what her aunt had done for her? Wren shivered in the closet beside Olive, who smelled like lemons and was being really nice. But all things considered, the odds that they could avoid getting caught hiding were pretty slim. At least Olive was old. That sounded terrible, Wren knew, but it was true. Olive had lived her life, or most of it anyway. There were hundreds of things Ren hadn't done. Sex, for one, but that was a given. She'd never broken her curfew. She'd never gotten trashed. She'd never gotten 100% on a math test or climbed up the water tower at Jackson State. She hadn't gotten her license either. She had a learner's permit. She'd applied for it the day she turned 15. Her father knew she had been waiting for this moment, and when she bounced into the kitchen on the morning of her birthday, he was already wide awake, as if he'd been waiting for her. He intentionally took his sweet time eating breakfast and finishing his cup of coffee while Ren squirmed, desperate to be taken to the DMV. "Give me a lesson," she begged, as they walked out of the building with that sacred piece of paper. "Now, why didn't I think of that?" he said, grinning, and he drove her to the police station parking lot, way out back, where they had summer Friday barbecues. He had set up an obstacle course of orange cones. He showed her how to adjust her mirrors and check her blind spots, and for 10 minutes alone, they practiced shifting the car from park into drive with her foot firmly on the brake. Eventually, he let her inch between the orange cones, moving 5 miles per hour. "You want to stay toward the middle, around the corners," he told her. "You never know who's on the other side."
"Got it."
"But seriously, Ren, there could be a biker."
"Okay."
"And maybe there's not a bike lane, so you turn the corner and you clip him, and he goes flying off his bike and smacks his head on the pavement, and then you get out and call 911 and follow him to the hospital, and you find out that he's dead, and you have to tell his family you're the reason why."
She glanced at him.
"Dad." "Eyes on the road."
"This isn't even a road."
He put up his hands in surrender. "Sorry. Turn left." She put on her blinker and rotated the steering wheel. "You know that you don't have the right-of-way."
"There aren't any other cars."
"But if you jump out in front of someone who's going straight and they T-bone you, it will probably take the jaws of life to get you out of the wreckage. And by then, your ribs could be broken and penetrating your heart, and you could slowly bleed to death."
"Dad."
"Sorry. It's just that there are a million drivers I don't know and don't trust. And there's only one you."
Ren put the car into park. "I'm not going to die in a car wreck," she vowed.
Her father looked out the window, eyes straight ahead.
Then he smiled, the same kind of half-smile she had seen on his face when she told him that she could read to herself at night now. The same kind of smile he'd had when she crossed the auditorium in 5th grade to get a silly graduation certificate. The same kind of smile as when she came downstairs for the first time wearing mascara and lip gloss.
"I'm gonna hold you to that," he said softly.
The shooter had herded the 5 of them into the waiting room. The front desk was littered with glass. There were pamphlets scattered all over the place and smears of blood on the carpet. Furniture had been piled against the front door as a barricade, a coffee table, a file cabinet, a couch. The television overhead was playing The Chew. Joy had left her purse and her phone in the recovery room when she ran away from the shooter. His name was George. She had heard him say it on the telephone. He looked like any of the male protesters who had been standing outside yelling at her as she ran into the clinic. She didn't listen to a single word they said, but she remembered a man holding a baby doll upside down by the foot with a knife sticking out of its belly. To be here today, she had switched shifts at the bar and said she was going to Arkansas to visit her family. If anyone else were going to be a casualty of a pro-life shooter, he'd pick the woman who'd just had an abortion. Was this the karmic price she had to pay? A life for a life? Would anyone even notice she was gone?
"Hey." Dr. Ward's voice floated toward her. "You all right?"
She nodded. "Are you?"
I'll live. Maybe.
He grinned faintly at his own joke.
It's joy, right? It's gonna be okay.
She didn't know how he could say that with such authority, but she appreciated it, the same way she'd appreciated his kindness during the procedure. If she died today, she'd be a footnote in a newspaper. She wouldn't finish her associate's degree. She wouldn't know what it was like to fall in love. She wouldn't have a chance to be the kind of parent she never had. A hysterical laugh bubbled in her throat. She was a hostage, at the mercy of a lunatic with a gun. The soles of her feet were literally soaked with the blood of others. She had stepped over a dead woman to get where she was sitting, and she might very well watch more people die before her eyes. She might even be one of them. But at least, she wasn't pregnant. To say this wasn't good was an understatement. Izzy knelt down in front of Bex. She had managed to get the woman out of her blouse and could see the exit wound of the bullet. It had gone through the right breast and out just above her right shoulder blade. But even with Janine pressing gauze onto the wound, Bex's bleeding hadn't slowed. "We're gonna take good care of you, Miss Bex," Izzy said, smiling down at her. The woman's breathing was labored.
I... "Don't try to talk," Dr. Ward said. "We'll patch you up like new. I can't risk sullying my reputation as a physician."
That, at least, brought a smile to the woman's face. Izzy squeezed her hand. "Can I?" Janine looked up at her. The girl's hands were covered with Bex's blood and quivering with the effort she was making to stanch the flow.
"No," Izzy said tightly, "you can't."
The phone rang again, and they all turned to stare at it. Last time, Izzy had been the one who answered it. The shooter had directed her to do it by jerking the gun in her face.
"Don't touch it," he barked now.
The phone rang 12 more times. Izzy counted. Bex's breathing was tighter, soupy.
"Hard," she said, "to catch my..."
Izzy reached for Bex's wrist, counting heartbeats for her pulse and doing the math. 240 beats per minute. Bex was tachycardic.
"She probably has a tension pneumothorax," Dr. Ward said. "We have to get the air out of her chest cavity so she can breathe freely."
He twisted, trying to haul himself upright on his good foot, but he lost his balance and crashed onto his bad leg. Izzy took the bulk of his weight. "The last thing we need right now is for you to play hero."
"What we need is a trauma doctor," he said, meeting her gaze. "And it looks like that's going to be you."
Izzy shook her head. "I'm not a doctor."
"That's just a bunch of letters after your name. You know what you're doing, I bet."
Izzy had seen needle decompressions done before, in a hospital setting, when they had sterile conditions and all the proper equipment. She also knew that Bex was not long for this world without some kind of immediate medical intervention. As air entered her pleural space from the wound, the pressure would increase and collapse the lung, which in turn would compress the heart and shift the mediastinum. That meant her heart wouldn't pump effectively, and the vena cava, the big vessel that returned all the blood to the heart, wouldn't do its job. Bex started wheezing, fighting for air. Her body shook with the effort. Izzy grabbed Janine's hand and pressed it down harder on the gunshot wound. Then she stood, summoning all her courage. "This woman needs medical attention," she told the shooter. He stared at her.
"Do you want her to die?"
What a stupid question. Of course he did. He wanted them all to die. It was why he'd come in with a gun.
"I can treat her,
but I need to get instruments in the procedure room.
You think I'm an idiot? I'm not gonna let you go off by yourself.
Then come with me, Izzy said, desperate. And leave them alone? He gestured around the waiting room.
I don't think so. Sit back down.
No, Izzy said flatly. He raised his eyebrows.
What did you say?
No. She began to walk toward the shooter. The gun was pointed at her belly, and her legs were like noodles, but she managed to take one step and then another until the barrel of the pistol was 6 inches away from her. I will not sit down, not until you let me get supplies, so I can save that woman's life. He stared at her for a moment that lasted days. Then he suddenly grabbed Joy and kissed the pistol to her head.
I'm counting to 10. If you do anything stupid, or if you don't come back, this woman dies.
A small, wounded whimper escaped Joy. Behind her, Bex was outright gasping for air.
One, the shooter said.
Two. Three. Izzy spun on her heel and raced down the hall to the procedure room. Four. She scrambled through drawers, flinging open cabinets, blindly grabbing whatever she could lay hands on, as if this were a macabre supermarket sweep. Five. She lifted the hem of her scrubs top and dragged her booty off the counter and into the makeshift basket. Six. Seven. She scrambled back to the waiting room, dumping her treasures all over the floor. The shooter let go of Joy, who fell, trembling, onto the couch and drew her knees up to her chest. Pick those supplies up, Izzy said to Janine. She pulled off the Johnny she had draped over Bex. The woman's eyes were wide and terrified. They fixed on Izzy as if she were the only mooring in a storm. Bex, she said firmly, I know you can't breathe. I'm going to fix that. I just need you to try to stay calm. Janine settled an armful of items beside Izzy, gauze and tubing, and a number 15 stab blade, a Kelly clamp, and a tenaculum, a curette. Izzy was a pro at fixing problems. When the stove broke, you made a campfire and boiled eggs by holding them up to the steam coming out of a kettle. When there was no milk for cereal, water worked. When you wore through the bottom of your shoe, you made an insole out of cardboard. If growing up poor teaches you anything, it's ingenuity. She picked up a 22-gauge needle. She had seen needle decompressions done before, but with bigger needles. This one was delicate, meant to inject lidocaine. It wasn't long enough or stiff enough to provide a release for the air building up inside Bex's chest cavity.
Not gonna work, Dr. Ward corroborated. You're going to have to put in a chest tube.
She met his gaze over Bex's body and nodded. Izzy pulled the tubing from its sterile plastic packet. She reached for a Kelly clamp and then picked up the stab blade. She wished she'd had the foresight to grab betadine or an alcohol wipe, but this would have to do. Lifting Bex's right arm, Izzy trailed her fingers to a spot between the fourth and fifth ribs and paused. Just because she had seen this done didn't mean she was qualified to do it herself.
Go on now, Dr. Ward urged. Make the cut.
She drew in her breath and pressed the scalpel deeply into Bex's skin. A thin line of blood rose. Izzy stuck her left index finger into the incision and felt for the chest wall, blocking out Bex's scream. She lifted the Kelly clamp with her other hand and slipped it through the incision.
You're going to have to push hard, Dr. Ward said.
Izzy nodded and maneuvered the nose of the clamp above the rib, then punched through the chest wall with a pop. Immediately there was a whoosh of air and blood spattered into her lap. Bex gasped, finally able to breathe. It had been not just a pneumothorax, but a hemothorax. Blood,
not air, had filled her pleural cavity. Izzy opened the clamp and twisted it back and forth to make a bigger opening in the chest wall. With her index finger, she felt the balloon of Bex's lung as it rose and deflated. She pulled out the clamp, keeping its nose open so that she didn't accidentally snag the lung. Keeping her finger still inside the chest cavity, she inched the suction tubing into the incision until it reached the tip. Only then did she slide her finger out. Izzy didn't have anything to hold the tube in place, or any way to suture it in. So she grabbed the plastic package that the tubing had come in and pressed it up against Bex's side to make an occlusive seal. Dr. Ward reached for the tape that she'd used to secure his tourniquet and ripped off two pieces for her to secure the plastic.
"Miss Izzy," he said, impressed. "If I didn't know better, I'd think you were born to the ER.
The tube had done its job. Blood was running from the tube and dripping on the floor. Izzy wrapped a towel around the end of it, wishing for a container. With a container, she could monitor how much blood Bex had lost. Eventually, if Bex didn't get a transfusion, she would die. Izzy felt a hand grab her shoulder. She turned to find the shooter, holding a wastebasket.
"Put it all in here," he said, jerking his head toward the discarded instruments on the floor.
She gathered the needle, the tenaculum, the bloody Kelly clamp, and all the items she hadn't used, and threw them inside.
"Is that it?" he demanded.
Izzy nodded. He weighed the gun, gesturing that he wanted her to step back so that he could see for himself. Satisfied that nothing had been left behind, he backed away and set the wastebasket beneath the receptionist's desk. Bex grabbed her hand. She already looked more alert and definitely more comfortable.
"Thank you,"
she murmured. She tugged until Izzy leaned down. Her voice was a prayer.
"Save my niece."
Izzy drew back, looking at her face. She nodded. Izzy fussed with the edges of the tape where it met Bex's skin. With her free hand, she reached beneath Bex's hip and retrieved the scalpel she had hidden there after making the incision. She leaned closer, her hands folded between her and Bex, so that only the two of them could see Izzy retract the blade and slip it through the neck of her scrubs, tucking it into her bra. Although Hugh had ordered the police to clear the area, there were still stragglers. The media, who were too stupid or ambitious to leave. Gawkers with their cell phones out, recording footage to post on social media. There were still a few of the protesters, too, although they'd moved a safer distance away to hold a prayer circle. Littered on the ground they'd seated were the hallmarks of their beliefs, a sign that proclaimed abortion is homicide, dolls painted with fake blood and abandoned in haste, limbs twisted on the concrete in their own miniature crime scene. Hugh couldn't remember the last time the cops had been called to an altercation here at the center. For years, the employees had coexisted with the protesters the way that oil and water settled in a jar, in the same space, but separate. Each side had an odd, grudging respect for the fact that, in spite of the obstacles, they both showed up every day to do the work they believed needed to be done. The protest had mostly been nonviolent and civil. Except, Hugh noticed, right now. A ripple of surprise ran through the protesters, triggering some innate reflex he had for impending trouble. He turned around in time to see a young woman with pink hair break through their little sanctimonious tangle. It was the girl he had interviewed an hour ago, the employee who had called 911 after running out of the center when shooting began, Rachel. She stood toe-to-toe with one of the protesters,
a tall, round man with a shock of white hair.
"Please," the man said, "come pray."
Hugh watched her poke the man in the chest.
"Alan, you do not get to act like this wasn't all your fault."
He was mildly surprised to realize she knew him by name.
"He's not one of us," Alan replied.
"How can you even stand here and say that?" she cried. "If people like you didn't spout the bullshit you do, people like him wouldn't exist."
Hugh took a step forward.
"This is an active hostage situation," he said. "You all need to go home."
"I can't," Rachel sobbed. "Not until I know everyone in there is safe."
"That's why we're praying. There's someone pro-life inside," said Alan.
Hugh ran a hand through his hair.
"Clearly."
The protester shook his head.
"Someone else," he clarified. "She's a hostage."
In 10th grade debate class, Janine had to debate Roe versus Wade. She argued to overturn it, her knees trembling as she pressed them together and said that abortion was ending a life. She had lost the debate, according to her teacher, who was pro-choice. But afterward, a girl named Holly came up to her and asked if she was busy Saturday morning. Which was how Janine wound up with her arms linked to those of two strangers who were part of Holly's church, forming a human life chain that stretched for a mile. Over the years, Janine had not wavered in her belief that life starts at conception. And yet, it was something she usually kept secret. Because when you admitted you were pro-life, people started looking at you like you were not so smart. Or like you were part of a religious cult. Or they said they were personally opposed to abortion, but believed in a woman's right to choose. That was like insisting, "I'd never abuse my kid, but I'm not going to tell my neighbor he can't beat his son." Janine had kept coming back to this truth like a lodestone. It was what brought her to Mississippi to work with Alan. They were so close, only one clinic away from ridding the state of abortion facilities. She liked the other protesters. In addition to Alan, there was Margaret, who had CP, and who said the rosary as patients passed. There was the professor who taught at the university. Ethel and Wanda handed out blessing bags as the women walked into the clinic. It had been Alan's idea that as their youngest member, Janine should start a vlog in which she explained, from a millennial point of view, why abortion was murder. Her first installment was going to be called Inside the Abortion Factory. She had wanted to get up close and personal, but she had never anticipated this. Janine had nearly thrown up when the nurse Izzy cut into Bex's flesh, without anesthesia, with Bex wide awake. The skin beneath the scalpel had divided to become a howling mouth, red and angry. Janine looked down at her own arms, covered to the elbows in blood, and suddenly it all hit her. She had had her hands in another woman's chest. She was trapped with a gunman who didn't realize that one of his hostages was just as disgusted by abortion as he was. She started to weave on her feet. Izzy looked up as Janine grabbed onto the wall for support. "Are you going to faint?" she asked. Her own voice was distant and buzzy, like that of the conductor on a train you could never really hear.
"I have to get out of here."
Izzy put a reassuring arm around Janine's shoulders.
"I have to get out of here," Janine said more firmly.
"Let's take some deep breaths," Izzy said, with a note of warning in her voice.
She flicked her eyes toward the gunman, who had turned around to stare at them.
"No,"
Janine wrenched away. She walked toward the shooter, who held the gun at waist level, pointed at her.
"Sir, excuse me, but I don't belong here."
she said, smiling at him.
Sit the hell down, he growled.
I'm like you, not them. I'm not a patient. I was here because, well, it's a long story.
She reached up and took off her blonde wig, revealing a pixie cut of dark hair.
I think abortion is a sin. They kill babies here. And they deserve.
She glanced around to find everyone in the waiting room staring at her in shock.
Please let me go, she begged.
Be quiet, the shooter demanded.
I promise I won't.
Stop talking.
I'll tell them you're a reasonable man, a good man, with a good heart, trying to give a voice to the unborn.
She took a step forward, emboldened.
You and I, we're on the same side.
Janine saw the shooter lift his weapon, and then everything went black. Nobody made a move to help the girl who'd been cold-cocked. Had he not been immobilized with a tourniquet, Louis couldn't even say for sure that he'd have done it. The Hippocratic Oath be damned. She must have come here to try to trap them. For years now, the antis had infiltrated clinics, trying to find proof of the mythology that fetal parts were being sold and that employees were forcing women to terminate late-term pregnancies. The result? People believed them. So much so that it inspired violence. In Colorado, a man shot up a Planned Parenthood because he was certain they were selling baby organs and tissue. Who knew what lies had driven the shooter here today? Louis knew all the protesters. It was really a matter of self-preservation. There were too many dark roads in Mississippi, too many places for his car to be driven off into a culvert, like they used to do to civil rights activists. So Alan had complimented him on his haircut recently. Wanda offered donuts to the staff every Monday. Reynaud, who wore the sandwich board with photos of body parts, didn't make eye contact with anyone. Mark only came on Tuesdays and sat on his walker, his oxygen tank in tow for his emphysema. Ethel, who knit the booties and caps that went into the blessing bags, had once given Louis a pair of mittens at Christmas. There were those who were more disruptive, protesters who took photos of the license plates of cars parked in the lot and published them on websites so that they could be harassed, protesters who had created a geofencing mechanism so that as you came within a couple hundred feet of the clinic, your phone's browser would be filled with anti-abortion advertising. When Louis checked Facebook at work, a pop-up reminded him that he could keep his baby. Davis, a young minister, blocked incoming cars with his body and screamed at the patients, telling them they were going to hell. Reverend Rusty from Operation Save America drove down from Wichita every couple of months in an old VW bus with a group of followers he could excite into a frenzy with his horsewhip voice and rattlesnake eyes. Every now and then there was someone new. Last March, a Christian college had a spring break trip to Mississippi, and a busload of fresh-faced college students picketed for a full week. There was a man who showed up for a few days with a snarling pit bull, but he disappeared as quickly as he'd come. There was the time about a year ago when a crazy protester barreled into the clinic and chained himself to an ultrasound machine, not realizing that they were portable and could be wheeled out, which was exactly how the police transported him from the building to arrest him. And apparently, there was Janine. With that wig off her head, he recognized her as an anti. He couldn't believe that they had been under the same roof and he hadn't recognized her until that moment. It made him feel foolish, violated. When Louis was a boy, Miss Essie would come visit and sit on their porch, and complain about the head of the ladies' auxiliary at church. Yet every Sunday she'd be cozying to the woman as if they shared a twin bed. "Better the devil you know than the devil you don't," she would say, when his grandmama called her on her hypocrisy. "Then find yourself more suitable company," his grandmama used to argue. Louis imagined that this young lady had been trying to save her own skin. Clearly, it had backfired. When she regained consciousness, would she apologize to the women who'd come to this center because they had reached the end of their ropes? Or to Izzy and himself, who fought society and politics and, yes, violence, to give those women a last chance? She could apologize 1,000 times to Vanita, the clinic owner, but it wouldn't bring her back to life. This woman, lying feet away from him, would probably be surprised to know that she was not the first pro-lifer to walk into the center. He had personally performed abortions on at least 12. Louis did not know a single colleague who hadn't done the same. These women claimed to be pro-life and insisted the fetus was sacred until it happened to be inside them and didn't square with their life expectations. They would come into the procedure room and say that it was different for them. Or they would bring their daughters and say that obviously this was an exception. Louis wanted to point out that everyone who walked through the center's door was someone's daughter, but he didn't. If these women burst into tears on Louis' table because they never imagined themselves there, he did not call them hypocrites. Any of us can rationalize the things we do, but he hoped empathy would spread, an invasive weed of compassion. A day or two later, after he performed their abortions, these same women would call him a killer again as he walked from his car into his place of work. He did not consider them frauds. He understood why they felt they had to go back to being who everyone else in their social circles believed them to be. Indeed, when pro-lifers came to him to terminate a pregnancy and told him that they did not believe in abortion, Louis Ward said only one thing: "Scoot down." Problem solved, Joy thought bitterly. Want to clear up a divisive issue? Throw all the parties into the crucible of a hostage situation and let them simmer. She looked down at the unconscious body of the woman who had been suffering beside her. Never in 100 years would it have occurred to her that she was an undercover anti-choice protester. If she had known, would Joy have even given her the time of day? This was karma, in its purest form. It wasn't as if Janine had just wandered into the wrong place, like Joy had. Yesterday, she had gone to the wrong clinic. Like the center, it was painted orange. It was literally around the corner from the center. The sign even said, "The Women's Center," as if they were deliberately trying to confuse patients. The waiting room was filled with posters of fetuses in different stages. "I am 6 weeks and I have fingernails. I am 10 weeks and I can turn my head and frown. I am 17 weeks. I just had a dream." It had seemed patently cruel to her to have these posters on the walls, but maybe they were meant to weed out the women who were still unsure of their decision. Joy closed her eyes so that she wouldn't have to look at them. She heard her name called, and a smiling woman with a dark cap of hair led her back to a cubicle. The woman wore a lab coat and had the name Maria embroidered over her heart in loopy script.
"How about we start with an ultrasound?" Maria said.
And Joy realized she was one of those women who spoke only in sentences with exclamation points.
"To see how far along your baby is."
On the examination table, Joy watched Maria squirt gel onto her belly and then rub the ultrasound wand around.
"Look at your little miracle," Maria said,
turning the screen toward her. On the screen was a fully formed, chubby, black and white baby. Joy had looked on the internet. She knew her 15-